The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Time now for us to check in with Jim Ellis, ellisinsight.com, for a look at the week in politics. And Jim, things are heating up, or interesting developments in the House Speaker race for Republicans.
Yes, I think that we're going to see much more focus in the coming days as we approach the day the House members are sworn into office, which is January 3rd. And the first thing they will do is vote for the next speaker. And the mathematics of the situation suggests that Kevin McCarthy, the California Republican, who is the minority leader and the nominee for speaker as elected by the Republican conference, you know, may not be adding up to the 218 that he needs, because he's got at least four Republicans saying they do not plan on voting for him on the floor, and another two questioning his leadership. Well, that's six. You have developments this week that have occurred. Again, we see no resolution to this, the last outstanding congressional race up in the Fresno area, where you've got a Republican leading by 593 votes, and it just seems to be stalled there. They claim there's still outstanding votes, but they're not counting them, and it just goes on and on and on. So that seat becomes important, because if the Republican holds on to win that, that would make the caucus 222, and so that would give him a four-vote cushion of the 218. But the other interesting thing, and unfortunate thing, is that a Democratic congressman from Virginia, Donald McEachin, passed away unexpectedly. I mean, he's been fighting cancer for 9 years, but it wasn't even his death this during the past week here was quite a surprise. And that reduces the Democrats then to 212. Now, that could come into play if there's a present strategy, which is being talked about. That means a member would vote present when his or her name is called, as opposed to voting for a candidate for speaker. Now, some believe that reduces the majority number. I'm not so sure it does, and I'm sure that's going to be a point of challenge if they try to move that. In other words, well, this person is really doesn't count in terms of the speaker race, so instead of 218, you might need 217 or 216, which could be important because it looks like it's going to be razor thin. You have to assume that all 212 Democrats will hold for who will be their nominee, which appears to be New York Congressman Hakeem Jeffries to take over as leader for Nancy Pelosi. And they will remain in lockstep. So McCarthy's margin here is very small, and he is going to need to strike some type of deal with the six members that are already either expressing opposition to him. These are Republicans. Or questioning his leadership ability. So it's going to be an interesting show here as we go through the Christmas holidays and approach the swearing-in day on January 3rd.
This past week, we heard the House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy hitting the Biden administration over the negotiations on the potential rail strike that was being talked about. Here's what he said.
The president told us all that this was solved long before the election. And now we find ourselves in the last moments, in the last hours, asking us to rush a bill to the floor.
I'm trying to sound like he's House Speaker-ish there, I guess. But what do you think will happen?
Yes.
I guess this stuff gets very dicey, because when you get close numbers on things, this becomes in the weeds and in the minutia. What do you give people? How do you build a consensus? What do some Republicans want that others don't?
It's going to be interesting, and he does have some things to negotiate here. And the answer to your question, Larry, is everybody's different. and everybody has a different request, I'm sure, either legislation being passed, some types of appropriations for their district, different committee assignments. It could go on and on and on. And it becomes a very difficult juggling act to get to that number. Now, if he doesn't, they just keep voting until somebody gets a majority. And the danger, I think, that they run into, they, the Republicans, if they try this present strategy, is he can't get below 212 or Hakeem Jeffries will be elected speaker. So he's really walking a very fine tightrope there. And obviously his best path is to make a deal with these Republicans, the six of them, who appear to be, you know, wanting to take a walk on him. And he's got to find some way to bring them back in some way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. And I got to believe he pulls it off in the end. And I think McCarthy will be elected speaker, because for these six, even though they might be out on a limb saying they're opposing him, to do something that might throw it over to the Democrats when the Republicans are in the majority would be unthinkable for most of them. So we'll it's going to be an interesting show. It really is.
It is. Jim Ellis, ellisinsight.com. Jim, what about what House members do once they get the gavel? I mean, I've talked to some Republicans who are frustrated that it seems like all they're talking about is holding hearings. It's the same thing the Democrats did. You can hold hearings till you're blue in the face. I think traditional media, the mainstream media, isn't going to carry them. So you'll be talking to the choir. What do you think there?
They do seem to be already coming out on this Hunter Biden investigation. I think the investigations and the oversight is a proper thing for them to be doing. And frankly, it's about the only thing that they can accomplish, because if the Democrats are going to hold the Senate, which we know they are, regardless of what happens in the Georgia election, the Democrats will be in the majority. And with the Republicans in the majority in the House, not much major legislation is going to be passed in this session. But oversight is a legitimate responsibility of the Congress, I think they'd be better off, the Republican majority, if they were talking about oversight of the government agencies to make them work better for the American people. I think people will respond a lot better to that, and I think they could get some good done from there. But if it's just going after Hunter Biden and trying to claim the Bidens are corrupt, regardless of the outcome of that, I don't think it's going to do much for them politically. But looking at the FBI corruption, looking at how the agencies run and make them work better for the American people, I think would be a good thing they could do. And I think they'd score some points for doing that.
Mm. Now to the 2024 presidential race. It seems strange that we're already talking about it, but you know, there's jockeying, maneuvering. Those getting their digs in about President Trump are kind of piling on, saying he's less electable this time than last time. I don't know. I just don't know. It's too early to say he's out. What do you think?
It's way too early, and the media loves to cover the presidential race. And so we knew that right after the midterms, we'd be into the 2024 presidential cycle, and it is going to be interesting. The thing to watch here in the next coming couple of weeks is how the Democrats change the rules for the nominating procedure for their party. They are going to. And they're definitely going to change the states that vote early. Like right now, we go to the Iowa caucus, to the New Hampshire primary, to the Nevada caucus, to the South Carolina primary. That looks like it's going to change. The Democrats are certainly going to drop Iowa. There's no doubt about that. And then they're going to make some other changes. I think they're going to require primaries, so getting rid of the caucus states. So they're going to make some major changes. And the person I would watch on this is Kamala Harris, because the White House will certainly have the major role in determining what these rules are. And that will be important in terms of the next nominee. And you know that Kamala Harris will be paying close attention and will be heavily involved in determining what rules are done to select the next nominee. And when they change the schedule, then it becomes interesting to see what the Republicans will do. Will they follow suit and adopt the same type of schedule, or will they continue to go their own way And then we'll have split primaries in split states, and people will be going to the polls twice. Republicans already say they're going to stay in Iowa. And so it's, for one example, so we can see some major changes here coming. Just in the next few weeks, the Democrats say they're about ready to release these new rules shortly. So I think that means within the next month.
Well, you don't change them unless you think it's going to increase your odds and exposure and benefit your candidates. And so the Democrats, you know, they've made a lot of changes in the election process, and they seem to have learned how to take advantage of those. Is there concern that Republicans are going to fall behind again, and they don't really want to do things that need to be done to win elections, and that Democrats are outsmarting them?
You know, I don't know. I think this is more of an internal situation. I mean, they certainly didn't like what happened in Iowa, and I don't blame them. That caucus formula was so complicated in terms of, are you a quarter of a delegate or a third of a delegate or an eighth of a delegate, that they can't tell you today with any clarity if Bernie Sanders or Pete Buttigieg actually won that caucus here back in 2020. So I can understand why they might want to dump Iowa, but the reason they're saying is they want states that better reflect the Democratic Party than these four, i.e., we need a system that elects the further left candidate. And that's really what they're saying. And I don't know if that plays into their benefit in the long run or not. It does in terms of internal party politics, which I think this is about. But they're definitely going to make some changes. And again, we'll see how the Republicans respond to that. And if otherwise, the nominating process for both sides could become more chaotic than it even has been in the past.
Other interesting stories quickly. Elon Musk and his battle,
yes,
with Apple on the App Store, and whether or not Apple would potentially drop him from there. That would have some pretty big ramifications. I know big tech is said to have this ability to, you know, put their thumb on the scale, but that would be putting an elephant on the scale, wouldn't it?
It sure would, and this is what happens when you don't go along with the left-wing narrative, isn't it?
I don't think you're going to hear much in the media against it, because they're for it.
No, that's right. Yes, that's right. That's right. If you don't go along, you're out. So this again, I think, underscores the whole base argument we've had on this Twitter situation about being, you know, about allowing free speech. And it's clear that big tech doesn't want to do that.
They certainly don't. You can buy yourself Twitter, but they're going to rally around and try to squeeze you out if they can. So that's to be continued. We'll see what happens there. Thank you, Jim Ellis. Jim Ellis, ellisinsight.com. Always appreciate your wise counsel.
Thank you, Larry.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Coming up, a conversation with Dr. Doty. He is a professor of economics and Chapman University president emeritus, and he joins us now. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Larry. Great to be on the show again.
When you're on, we always talk economics. We talk impact of things going on. And what sparked our interview today is a discussion of how a potential downturn in the economy might impact the state coffers. And let's start right there. There's a story in the news about how, you know, 6 months to a year ago, there was some $95 billion surplus. And I'm told we have a huge deficit. Just like that. How did that happen? Let's start there. How do you eat up all that money?
Well, first of all, there was never a $95 billion surplus. That was a terrible figure to put out in the press. The way the state came up and the governor came up with that figure was not to count certain expenditures. In other words, certain kinds of required expenditures, educational expenditures, K-12 expenditures, which are mandated by proposition, by law, those expenditures were excluded from the tabulation of a bottom line. Oh. So if you exclude all kinds of expenses, obviously you're going to end up with a large surplus. If I could make an analogy, it would be like a corporate concern. I don't know, let's just say Microsoft, to say, let's just exclude all of our purchases from China for some silly reason. The profits would go way up, but there's no reason to exclude those expenditures. So the deficit was, the surplus was never $95 billion. It was more like $22 billion. That's the actual surplus from 21-22. And that was mainly as a result of COVID payments, relief payments from the federal government to the state of California.
Okay, so the budget wasn't what it was. And then how about the deficit? Those become real, huh? The surpluses are fake, but the deficits are real.
Yeah, so to make matters worse, in 21-22, in that budget, the federal government was sending billions and billions and billions of dollars to the state of California, which it included in its revenues. That contributed to a surplus, not 95 billion, but a surplus of $22 billion for 21-22 because of federal government one-time only COVID payments. So what happened was then the state of California, in their insane way they account for things, their accounting treatment, this would never pass generally accepted accounting principles at the corporate level. Anyway, they took that surplus, which was largely the result of one-time only federal government payments, and they included that as a revenue in the 22-23 budget. In other words, well, we made a surplus. Let's put it all now into the current fund. So $22 billion of the revenues that are currently in the 22-23 budget is from this prior year surplus, which will disappear at the end of the year because we're not getting those COVID payments from the federal government. So all of a sudden, you're getting a swing in next year's budget, 23-24, which they are now preparing, of $22 billion. That disappears because that surplus, which you included in revenues, goes away. So all of a sudden you have that problem. Secondly, and this is a much more important problem, Fidel Lawandi and I wrote an article in the Orange County Business Journal about it, and that's our concern about the possibility of a recession next year and how that would magnify the problem significantly for that 23-24 budget. Mm.
So you don't have the recurring gift from the federal government. I call it a gift with underlines and air quotes because it's, tax dollars we probably don't even have there. It's pushed into the budget for this year. It won't be next year. We're spending like it was there and we'll be in a hole. And then if things turn a little south, some of the revenue stream that that businesses owe will go down, right?
Yeah, and that's why you probably read recently, maybe 2 weeks ago, the Legislative Analyst Office came up and they did an assessment of the budget, and it pointed to next year the possibility. I think they talked about a $30 billion deficit, and that basically is occurring because of what I just talked about. That is, the surplus that was resulting from COVID relief payments goes away, which means that surplus, which was included in current year revenues, is not going to be there next year. And that's what the legislative analyst was talking about. But they made a very clear point, the legislative analyst, which is an independent body, by the way, made it very clear that does not include the possibility of recession. If there's a recession, there would be a deficit over and above that figure. So you're losing the government relief payments. That's like a $25 billion problem. And now you have this potential for recession. And that's the particular issue that Fidel and Lawandi and I addressed in our recent op-ed, where we talked about what might happen to the state of California if there is a recession next year.
Well, let's talk about that, because I know that unlike the federal government, California is not allowed to just print money and put it out there. We can't just instantly borrow on ourselves and just kind of paper things over, can we?
No, that's an excellent point. Unlike the government, which can print money, essentially, to fund its deficit or borrow, at the state level in California, that's not permissible by statute.
So that puts us in a bind where if you don't have the money, you can't spend it. And if there are services or things that are being paid for by the government, there goes the funding. They can't reauthorize it. Could this be?
That's right. So,
go ahead. Talk what can happen.
Yeah. So when the budget is being prepared for 23-24, if there's, let's say there's a recession, it's clear that revenues are dropping, that has to be addressed in the budget, which means it would force a significant, a rather severe drop in the budget for expenditures.
Is there a lot to play with in this? I mean, it seems I've always had the theory that you could cut a lot up there because it's a lot of waste. But there is some bone. There are some services that keep people fed and taken care of, aren't there?
Yeah. Before we address that, because I think there is some fat in the budget, and I have some numbers to I think, support that view. But before we do that, I just want to point out what the potential recessionary impact might be if there is a recession. First of all, remember, we have a $25 billion deficit just to begin with. And the legislative analysts supported that figure. That's the figure because we're not getting support subsidies from the federal government anymore as a result of COVID relief payments. Over and above that, we looked and analyzed the previous recessions, and I'll give you an example, and that is in 2000-2001 recession, California had a 17% drop in personal income taxes and a 58% drop in capital gains taxes, and a similar kind of negative impact in the Great Recession of 2008-2009. Very, very sharp drop. Now, in California, it's we're particularly vulnerable to recessions, unlike other states, because so much of our revenue base comes from capital gains and personal income tax. In fact, it's 72% of the state's budgeted revenues comes from those two sources, capital gains and personal income tax, not real estate, not sales tax, not corporate taxes. Right. But personal income tax and state budgets at 72%.
Right.
That compares to 62% back in the year 2010. So there's been a sharp increase over time in the proportion of the most volatile element of revenue. So if there's a recession, most states, there'll be an impact, but it will not be as great as California because so much of our revenue base comes from that portion of the budget, which is most volatile.
And
so our analysis is if we have just a normal recession, an average recession next year, and based on what happened in the prior recessions, we would estimate that the state would lose roughly $38 billion, which would be over and above the deficit caused by the drop in revenues because we're not going to have a surplus.
And Dr. Doty,
in total, yeah.
I was going to say real quickly, isn't this caused by a very small number of high earners, extremely wealthy people like in the tech industry that their fortunes pay a lot of the bills? Right? Isn't that reality?
Exactly. Yeah, and especially recently, there have been huge run-ups in tech company stock. And as those sales have occurred, that results in huge capital gains, increases in personal income, and ultimately those big earners up in the Silicon Valley support a great deal of the budget and explains why the proportion of revenue coming from personal income tax and capital gains taxes, why those taxes have increased so much as a proportion of the budget, where now it's, you know, approaching almost 80% of the budget.
Well,
and again, it makes us vulnerable to a recession if the stock market drops, if those companies don't do as well, if those earners aren't going to be earning the kind of income, either in capital gains revenue or personal income tax revenue. That's going to have a significant impact on the bottom line and on the state coffers.
Dr. Doty Chapman, University President Emeritus, you're also an economist over there, and you watch these things. What a fascinating subject. We appreciate you being with us.
Thank you. It's always great to be on the show.
Coming up, what California taxpayers can be thankful for.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino. AM 590, The Answer. You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
John Kapol is president of the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, and he is visiting with us. John, thank you so much for being with us.
It's always a pleasure, Larry. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. You recently did a piece that was timed for last weekend titled What California Taxpayers Can Be Thankful For, and it's an interesting read in that we just came off of an election where I think a lot of Republicans or conservatives felt like it was more of the same old, same old. That Democrats pretty much got a lot of what they want, and Republicans got a little bit of what they wanted, but it wasn't, you know, this red wave that had been forecast by some of the pundits and the pollsters. First, your reaction to the election, and then into what we can be thankful for.
Well, first of all, I think the reaction to the election has given those, and I won't use Republican versus Democrat, I'll just say fiscal conservatives versus progressives. I do think the election gave fiscal conservatives a roadmap for how to conduct elections in the future. I think one of the things that people fail to realize is that the progressives have a get-out-the-vote machine that is second to none. They can go out, and particularly in those states where ballot harvesting is allowed, they really have the upper hand. And I know that the Republicans complain about that, but if they ever needed a kick in the pants, this is, look, in those states where it is legal, Larry, it is incumbent upon those people who feel they're being abused by progressives to get out there and register voters, and not only register voters, but on election day, get out there and start banking those votes early before election day. Otherwise, we start out every election behind. Now, a critical test, I believe, about whether or not the Republican Party has learned its lesson will be in Georgia on the election coming up in early December for the Senate seat that has remained unresolved. We will see whether the Republicans, who most of whom are fiscal conservatives, have learned their lesson on how to get out the vote. And so this is more of a political issue, Larry, than it is a policy issue. I do not view the failure of California voters to adopt very conservative policies as anything other than the fact that the state of California is in the throes, under the control of one-party rule. And I will point to one huge disappointment here in California about the last election, and that is the failure of Lanny Chen to win as controller of the state of California. And the reason I say that, number one, the importance of that office for taxpayers is critical, because the controller controls all the checks that are written, and not only is responsible for being the fiscal steward of the state of California, but also someone with a strong backbone in that office can also do performance audits of programs to see where money is being wasted. And unfortunately, the controllers in the state of California have not done that in the past. notwithstanding the fact of the outrageous level of waste, fraud, and abuse we have in this state. Lonnie Chen was the Republican, and he, even though he was Republican, Larry, he had the endorsement of every single newspaper in California, including the very progressive ones. And it's just a shame. That tells us that we have a lot of work cut out.
Yeah, I referred to him as the Republicans' last best hope on election night. But he went down to defeat, and although the margins weren't the same as the others, it almost looked as if the percentages on most of these statewide offices were basically based on registration. If you're Democrat, you don't know these people. You don't know what a controller does. You just kind of go and fill in the one that has the Democrat next to it. I mean, it's very frustrating. It means that he failed to reach enough people to convince them, even with the newspapers. Well, enough talking about the past, though. Let's get to what your piece was titled, What Taxpayers Can Be Thankful For. And they can't be thankful for some of the tax measures that were passed on election night, because voters did that as well. Some sort of tax here in Southern California, like on sales of properties over $4 or $5 million, a certain percentage goes to, quote, homelessness, you know, more down that rat hole. I hate to call it that, but they don't seem to solve these problems, but they get people to sign up for more taxes.
Yeah, I will say, and what you're referring to is that very substantial tax on real estate transfers that was approved by the voters by virtue of Measure ULA. But I will also be quick to point out that the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association also opposed Measure SP, which was a partial tax, and that did go down to defeat. So there were some silver linings there. And also at the state level, Larry, as we all know, that massive increase in the income tax that would have hit high wealth individuals, Proposition 30, to fund various environmental green causes, also went down to defeat. So this notion that California is solidly socialistic. Yes, we're a liberal state, we're a progressive state, but every now and then the voters will surprise us. I do believe, and I was just talking with somebody else, in fact, someone who was in the legislature as a Democrat, a very moderate Democrat, who is very much on our side on a number of issues. He is no longer in the legislature, but he was saying that even moderate Democrats are very, very unhappy with how the progressives, the super progressives, and I will even say openly socialists, have taken over many of the offices. So I do think that there's some opportunities there for, again, disregarding party label for the moment, that we could have moderate Democrats, Republicans, and people who have a brain cell in their skull come out and oppose these horrible policies that result in one of the biggest concerns I have, and that is the number of individuals and businesses leaving the state of California. And that is truly troubling. And I think it's something that is so bad that even Governor Newsom realizes that this gravy train has got to stop at some point. So I do think that is something we can look to, that California is not, at least on fiscal issues, on social issues, clearly very, very progressive. I think on fiscal issues, it's mixed. Where that leads us going forward, it's going to be hard to tell. I will say this, if there is another silver lining on the Measure ULA proposal, and that is there is a pending initiative called the Taxpayer Protection Act that we're sponsoring along with the business community. And we've already turned in the signatures, and it's on the verge of qualifying. It's 1.4 million signatures, and I think everybody recognizes that it will qualify for the 2024 ballot. Now, when it qualifies, it will be on the ballot. If it passes in 2024, it will require many taxes that are like ULA to have to go back before the voters and secure the two-thirds vote that it otherwise would have had to get under Proposition 13. So that's another silver lining, and that is some of these taxes, not all, that were approved by the voters in November, by less than two-thirds vote, many of them will have to go back to the voters and secure the two-thirds vote required under Proposition 13.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I mean, just to bring it in line with the scope and the thoughts of Prop 13 and the protections that need to be in place. Prop 13, I guess, is another blessing. So far, you've been able to fend off challenges to that. It wasn't on this one, but the election before, Prop 13 was, you know, they were going to do split roll and take it off to start raising the taxes on the properties that are commercial properties. They didn't even float an initiative on this one, did they?
They didn't. And remember, when Proposition 15, that was the split roll initiative, lost two cycles ago, that was a cycle that the progressives had everything in their favor. Number one, Trump was on the ballot in 2020, and Trump, love him or hate him, is not well-liked in California. It was all mailed ballot. There's a lot of ballot harvesting going on. The progressives had a lot of issues on the ballot that favored them, and yet they still could not pass the split roll initiative, which I think is a testament to the enduring popularity of Proposition 13. And we confirm this, Larry, in benchmark polling that we do periodically, that even though, remember what California was like in 1978. You know, this is the Reagan, this is the era of Reagan and Pete Wilson, George Duke Majan. The Republicans were very, very strong in this state, and no longer. And so people say, well, Prop 13 isn't going to last very much longer. But if Prop 13 were on the ballot today, surprisingly, it would pass by about the same two-thirds margin that it did back in 1978.
Because Democrats own businesses and properties and can't afford
and homes,
right, and homes, yeah, and can't afford to pay the taxes as they get older on them. If they get to rise at exorbitant levels, they'd be priced out of their homes as well. And so the secret is you've connected with both sides of the aisle, and that is unique in these times. And John, I don't know if you survey your members as far as their party affiliation, but you've got to have some members on both sides of the aisle in that organization. And maybe some of those Democrats are quietly sending their contributions in unmarked envelopes.
Yes. And we've made no secret of the fact that a third of our members are Democrats. Now, the third of our members who are Democrats are what we call Reagan Democrats, which are, you know, conservative voting Democrats, many of them senior citizens who live in the Central Valley, places that the only reason they're Democrats is because they've always been Democrats. Yeah. But the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association has always been nonpartisan.
Yeah, let's give right the email address or website or whatever. I want to direct them toward you.
Sure, it's hjta.org, hjta.org. And we receive no government support, and we would love all California homeowners to join our organization so we can continue to protect you.
John Cabal, thank you so much for being with us.
You bet, Larry. Always a pleasure.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Nikki Gosar is the executive director of the Crime Prevention Research Center. She is joining us right now to talk about the impact of delays on murder cases and the taking of the death penalty off the table, what impact that has. Nikki, thank you so much for being with us on our program today.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for having me on.
You also have a book.
Stalked and Defenseless, How Gun Control Helped My Stalker Murder My Husband in Front of Me.
Let's start with the headlines. A case where there was a mass shooter at a school, and years later there's the trial. But then there's the taking of the death penalty off the table, or at least not getting the death penalty. You want to tie all this together, that we're making a mistake as society in some of the things we're doing here if we really want to prevent murders, right?
Yeah, absolutely. In the case of the Parkland shooter, Nicholas Cruz, you know, it took 4 years and 9 months before he was actually sentenced for murdering 17 people at Parkland. And, you know, one thing about him, he did not kill himself at the crime scene. He lived. And for those murderers that do live, because let's face it, many of them do commit suicide. But for the ones that live, that the criminal justice system has to deal with and victims have to face in court, it's really important to have the death penalty on the table. And you've got to be serious about using it. And what the death penalty does, a lot, these guys don't want to die. They do not want the death penalty. They don't want it. We see this time and time again. It's a hard life in prison on, you know, death row. But Nicholas Cruz, he fought against the death penalty. He did not want it. And he ended up accepting a plea deal for first-degree premeditated murder. He will stay in prison for the rest of his life. And no one else needs to fear him being out in public and harming others. And the victims and their families, you know, they don't have to go through a really painful, stressful trial and long and drawn out. You know, if somebody will just take a plea deal, then you can save a lot of grief and heartache and taxpayer dollars, quite frankly. So I feel it's really important.
Yeah, but you have to, you're saying, but you have to have the potential of the death penalty out there looming to get that. If you take it off the books, then there's really no reason to cut a deal or cooperate, and then you have to have that painful trial. What about places like California, where you have Governor Newsom, who ran for office in the state. The state had a death penalty on the books, but he basically, in good conscience, cannot enforce that. That you have some elected officials that just won't go there. I don't want to call it a wokeness that has taken over this country, but there's some people who just passionately are opposed to it. They think if you're opposed to someone taking a life, then you need to be opposed to any life being taken. You know the arguments, right?
Right. A lot of people make the analogy with abortion, and I think that's completely different. A child is innocent, and mass murderer is a serious crime. They've destroyed the lives of many, many people, and they're a danger to society. Completely different. But, you know, there's another thing that people don't think about, and that is these trial delays and what that does to victims of violent crime and their families. I myself have been through this, and it's horrible. I'm a victim of a violent crime. My husband, Ben, was murdered right in front of me by a man who was stalking me. This was 13 years ago. And, you know, this man has continued to stalk me from prison. He sends twisted love letters, and now he's facing a federal stalking charge. And even that trial has been delayed multiple times. And what that does to victims, you know, for victims, it causes a lot of anxiety and fear. You start having nightmares right before the trial because you know it's coming up. You know you've got to face your attacker in court. And it causes a lot of, you know, mental and emotional trauma. But then when they go and delay and then delay again and delay again.
Wow, that is a horrific story. I mean, the delays are punishment over and over again. There's a story actually out here, Nikki. We have cases being dropped because there aren't enough judges or courts to hear them out in Riverside County. I don't know if it's made national story, but I mean, we've got some real problems with delays, with not enough judges, with not enough courtrooms. Is it delays because of a reason? I mean, people are entitled to a speedy and fair trial, and if you can't provide it, there are loopholes that let people out, and then there are delays just to delay. In your particular case, what were the reasons on the delay?
Oh, mental health experts, you know, mental health experts being involved and evaluating him over and over and over again. And then, you know, not deciding whether they want a bench trial or a jury. And, you know, the defense attorneys are often the ones that do these delays. And it really has a mental and emotional impact on victims. It's like torture. Yeah. You know, we just want to get it over with.
Right.
We just want to get it over with.
What ultimately happened in your case?
My husband's murderer, unfortunately, the judge was a liberal judge in Nashville, Tennessee, and he dropped from first degree premeditated murder to the lesser offense of only second degree. So my stalker got 23 years in prison, but he's been allowed early release good behavior credit. So he really only has to serve 19 and a half years, which means this man is going to be released in just 6 more years. Mm-hmm. And it's terrifying for me because he's been stalking me from prison. He's still obsessed. This behavior is still going on. And I think he's very, very dangerous. And it is terrifying. So I'm going to have to go face him in court again for the federal stalking charge. And that's a max of 5 years additional prison time when he's convicted. Mm-hmm. So he's still going to get out.
We have a society and we have courts and judges and DAs that have gone down this path that too many people have been held for too long, that they have some theory of a certain social justice or court justice, that the wrong people have been unfairly held at too much of a rate, and therefore we have to err on the side of letting more people out. I mean, look, they emptied out the jails out here when COVID came along. Any excuse to get them on the streets. Crime has soared, smash and grabs and break-ins, follow homes, stabbings, all up. But there is this thought among certain prosecutors that we went too far the other way. I mean, what's your take?
I understand that there needs to be due process, and I absolutely think that it's very important. Due process is very important. But you know what else is important? A speedy trial, not just for the criminals, but for the victims as well. I think the victims have gotten lost in all of this.
Yeah, and you know, there's also these prosecutors that don't really want to notify victims when it's time for them to go to a hearing or be a part of it anymore. I mean, it's wacky. It's all changed. We have a DA here in Los Angeles that, if you followed Gascon, that just feels that the system needs to be weighted more on the other side than it has been. And yeah, things shift back and forth. You remember the day, I think it was probably in the 90s when I was doing talk radio, and it was all about 3 strikes. And, you know, I was all for 3 strikes. And then they come along and say, well, you know, don't you realize that 3rd strike could be something like stealing a pizza? And then they lock him up, and I would say something like, well, yeah, but the guy's got some violent tendencies. I want him off the streets. And then you went through years of doing that, and then people thought, well, there needs to be a restorative justice. Just because someone has done terrible things doesn't mean that they should have their life entirely ruined, even though they've ruined the lives of other people. I mean, this issue is debated back and forth, and it seems like the other side's winning right now. That's the frustrating part.
Yeah. Well, do I believe that some people can be restored and become great members of society again? Yeah. I believe that's possible. But when it comes to violent offenders, like really violent offenders, rapists, murderers, pedophiles, no. Now, I don't think those people can truly be reformed. Maybe there are a few. If someone was extremely young when, you know, they were involved in a criminal activity that was violent. But, you know, someone that's a grown adult that makes a decision like that, that changes, ruins so many people's lives. You know, I wanted to be a mother. I'll never be a mother now. I'm 46 years old. I'm a widow. I've not remarried and I have no children. And this was a choice forced on me by one evil individual.
Yeah. The other thing, by the way, is if somebody doesn't have any resources, there's no reason going after him civilly. I mean, unless this guy's the heir apparent to some, you know, huge fortune, nobody's going to take your case if you were to try to clean him out for money. That's our justice system. That is the American way. That's why you see all these ads on TV going after, you know, certain churches and different businesses because they know there's money to get. Have you ever thought of trying to pursue them civilly, or is there nothing there?
I did, and I won. However, he's indigent, so I get nothing. But it was the principle of the matter, and if, look, if he's ever willed anything in the future, yeah, I'll end up getting it. But no, he's indigent.
All right, give us the book title again.
Stalked and Defenseless, and you can find that at Amazon online and also Barnes & Noble online. And I would encourage your listeners to check out our website at the Crime Prevention Research Center. Our website is crimeresearch.org.
Nikki Gosu, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And we are out of time on this edition of our program. We'll be back with you next week. Check us out online at am590theanswer.com.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino. AM 590, The Answer.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.